Through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, Play Radio Station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALMP Athol, WDJM Framingham.
It is time to begin the reading of the Boston Globe on the Talking Information Center for today, Wednesday, the 8th of July, 2026. And we say hello to Karen and Pam. Pamela.
Well, greetings, listeners. This is Karen.
And this is Pamela.
Welcoming all of you to today's reading of the Boston Globe. And let's start with today's lead story, as always. Plattner's still in, but hopefuls line up. Maine Democrats already focused on next nominee. Graham Plattner hasn't yet announced whether he'll continue his Senate campaign in Maine following a bombshell rape allegation that landed Monday. Maine Democrats, however, are rapidly moving forward without him. Under Maine law, Plattner can be replaced as the Democratic nominee if he withdraws before July 13th, which seems increasingly inevitable as his support collapses across the party. The party would then have until July 27th to select a replacement. But there is no obvious existing procedure for this situation, leaving Democratic officials scrambling to devise a process to replace Plattner that is fair, open, and can be concluded in time. Meanwhile, at least a half dozen possible contenders waiting in the wings are competing for position and letting news media know they are receiving supportive calls. Progressive and moderate factions both in and outside Maine are escalating online battles that have become nasty, demanding the other side be blocked from influencing who succeeds Plattner as nominee. For voters, activists, and even potential candidates, it's a heady mix, and one without precedence in living political memory in the state. Nirav Shah, former chief of the Maine Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who placed second in this year's gubernatorial primary, is one of the leading Democrats to register interest in a Senate campaign. In an interview, Shah said the top priority among Democrats must be establishing a process that produces a candidate ready for the immense challenge and scrutiny that comes with a nationally watched Senate race. This is Game of Thrones right now, and everyone's going to be jockeying, Shah said. I want to make sure that what comes out is that the nominee is ready for action. The chaos is turning Maine, on paper Democrats' best shot to flip a Senate seat this fall, into an ominous mark on their map. Even before Politico reported Monday on Jenny Brasico's claims that Plattner raped her in 2021, the candidate was on tenuous footing. His campaign already beset by scandals and damaging revelations about his past. Plattner has denied any non-consensual activity. In recent weeks, several polls showed Plattner running neck and neck with Collins, despite an abysmal overall political environment for Republicans. It's possible Democrats wind up with a stronger challenger to Collins when the dust settles, if it ever does, given the intra-party warfare that broke out following the Politico story. Democrats who share Plattner's left-wing populist vision are insisting his successor be someone with the same vision, arguing that would reflect the will of Democratic voters who overwhelmingly backed Plattner in the June 9th primary. In fact, Plattner himself is reportedly pushing to secure an aligned candidate to take his place before withdrawing. That could be Troy Jackson, the former president of the Maine Senate, who placed third in the Democratic gubernatorial primary. He campaigned closely with Plattner and shares many supporters with him, including labor unions and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. But Democrats closer to the center, primarily outside Maine, are furious with Plattner and his progressive allies from Maine and beyond, arguing they are responsible for the debacle. Left-wing groups aligned with Sanders have already endorsed Jackson. When Representative Ro Khanna of California, formerly a staunch defender of Plattner, who appeared with him only weeks ago, praised Jackson as a possible successor, backlash was swift. "You've done enough damage in Maine," responded Jim Kessler of the center-left think tank Third Way on X. "We cannot nominate a Democrat covered in the stench of Plattner or his accomplices." The list of possible contenders is growing along with the prospects for factional warfare. In addition to Jackson, there are two other runners-up from the gubernatorial primary seen as viable candidates, Shaw and Secretary of State Shenna Bellows. Shaw, still well-liked for leading Maine's response to the COVID pandemic, said he began receiving a huge volume of encouraging calls and texts almost immediately after Politico's story went live. He said he has not yet decided whether to run, but nonetheless sketched out an argument showing how he could appeal to Plattner supporters as well as independents and Republicans. But he said Democrats can't lose sight of the ultimate goal amid the factional disputes around a Plattner replacement. All of this must be angled around one question: who can defeat Senator Collins, Shaw said. If that happens to be a natural successor to Graham politically, well then great. But ultimately, what's going to matter is who can defeat her. Jackson also took steps toward a run. His allies began circulating a video touting his credentials as a progressive and fifth-generation logger from northern Maine. And on Tuesday, he filed paperwork with the Federal Election Commission to create a Senate exploratory committee. In a statement Tuesday night, Jackson confirmed he was considering a bid and spoke directly to Plattner supporters who are hurting amid the news about his conduct. "Together, we can bring our shared progressive vision to life," said Jackson, "and we can unseat Susan Collins once and for all." Bellows, meanwhile, previously faced Collins in 2014 and lost decisively. But since then, she has built a reputation as an aggressive counter to President Trump and her role as Secretary of State. She drew national headlines and intense GOP backlash for moving to disqualify Trump from the 2024 ballot. On Tuesday evening, Bellows confirmed she was interested in entering the race and called herself uniquely fit to unite Mainers and defeat Susan Collins in just over 100 days, according to the Mid-Coast Villager. Bellows and Jackson hail from the left wing of the party, and both were endorsed for governor by Plattner, who urged voters to select them in Maine's ranked choice primary, along with Hannah Pingree, who ultimately won. Plattner did not recommend a vote for Shaw. While Shaw has embraced policy positions like Medicare for All, progressive activists and groups did not line up behind his candidacy. Another possible contender is Dan Klebun, co-founder of Maine Beer Company, who briefly ran for Senate before dropping out when Governor Janet Mills entered the race. Klebun is well-connected in Democratic circles. He has received calls encouraging him to run, according to a source close to him. Pamela?
Thank you, Karen. Working out the bugs in effort to slow warming. Methane-eating microbes could help with potent greenhouse gas. Scientist Kathleen Savage leaned out from the basket of a boom lift, a red safety helmet perched on her head. She sealed a few needle-covered stalks from an eastern hemlock tree inside a clear plastic cylinder and pulled out her phone. On the screen, a meter rose and fell as the level of gases inside the cylinder fluctuated. The question she was asking, what were the microscopic bugs on the stalks and leaves doing in there? The answer would provide limited data, just one point, from one portion of a tree in one forest. But looked at another way, it could also buy the planet critical time as the world races to address the climate crisis. These small microscopic organisms are everywhere, she said. When you translate that to an entire forest, they add up and pack a big punch. Savage, a senior research scientist at Widwell Climate Research Center in Woods Hole, is part of a team of experts trying to better understand which of these microscopic bugs, or as they're technically called, microbes, consume potent methane gas, and where they could eventually be marshaled as a tool to combat climate change. Methane is among the world's most potent greenhouse gases, accounting for roughly 30% of global warming. Once emitted, it only lasts in the atmosphere for a little over a decade, but in that time, it's 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide. Global methane levels have been steadily rising since the industrial era began, thanks primarily to our reliance on fossil fuels, an explosion of factory farming and animal agriculture. Cows are responsible for more than a third of all the methane that humans produce. There are natural sources, too. Water temperatures on the planet are speeding up natural processes, including the breakdown of organic matter in places like wetlands and marshes. It's what's known as a climate feedback loop. The warmer the planet, the more methane that gets released, which warms the planet further, and so on. All that methane makes it critical to identify sources that break it down, like the trees in Howland. In 2021, the United States and Europe championed the Global Methane Pledge, a voluntary goal to reduce methane emissions at least 30% below 2020 levels by 2030. Nearly 160 countries have signed on. But global methane levels continue to rise. One of the biggest unknowns lives in the Arctic, where massive amounts of methane are trapped inside the permafrost, a frozen layer of ground. As the planet warms, the permafrost is rapidly thawing, and what stands to be released amounts to a carbon bomb that could speed up the rate of global warming. Which brings us back to those methane-eating microbes. The planet is crawling with microbes, which includes bacteria, viruses, and fungi. A single tree can have 3 trillion bacteria living inside it, so in total, the planet contains some unaccountably large, unnamed number, said Jonathan Gewurztman, ecosystem ecologist and biogeochemist who recently finished his PhD at the Yale School of the Environment. Microbes have different jobs. Some cause diseases. Some help cure them. Some break down dead organisms. Some provide food for them. Microbes live on and in plants and soil and animals, including us humans. And while some of them create methane, emerging research is showing that some of them like to eat it too. When the methane-consuming microbes are present, less methane comes out, Gewurztman said. And that's the key. If scientists can figure out which ones eat methane and in what circumstances, they could theoretically create more opportunities for them to do that and eliminate more methane from the atmosphere. Their work could get a boost from new legislation in Washington, D.C. Late last month, a bipartisan bill called the Methane Removal Research and Innovation Act was introduced. If enacted, it would establish a federal research effort to look into the development of potential strategies for removing methane from the environment, including methane-consuming microbes. Right now, the research is in its early stages, Ms. Savage said. She and her colleagues are still asking the big questions. Are these microbes in soil, on the surface of trees, on leaves? They're testing all three. And do they come out at certain times of day, in specific seasons, or during particular weather events? Looking into that, too. As they answer those questions, they will aim to identify the hero microbes, a process that can be relatively simple if the microbes captured happen to be among the ones that have been previously identified and sequenced by scientists. But if they are unknown ones, things get more complicated, requiring scientists to become detectives of sorts, looking for clues to understand how a specific microbe behaves and why. Just imagine where this could go. Several phases into this work, scientists could theoretically make a spray containing methane-eating microbes native to a specific place and introduce it to a forest, Savage said. Suddenly, a place that was once a net creator of methane could become a net sink, a place that can absorb methane from the natural world and essentially erase some of those emissions. Even a small reduction in methane concentration in the atmosphere has a big effect on reducing the potential warming, she said. The thought is that this gives us more time to address the bigger problems of CO2 emissions. Savage and her colleagues aren't alone. Ecosystem scientist and biogeochemist Vincent Gauci has also been researching how trees reduce methane and is doing similar work in West African forests, where his team is working to better understand how microbes on trees can reduce methane and how those processes can be used in commercial tree planting for more wide-scale methane reduction. Though he sees the promise in finding ways to inoculate seedlings with methane-eating microbes, he advocates for a simpler approach. I think the big win is to expand our forest, simply plant more trees and let them do the work, said Gauci, who is a professor at the University of Birmingham. It's not clear yet what the best approach is, said Megan Malamed, an atmospheric scientist who directs the methane removal program at California-based Spark Climate Solutions. But what's promising about using microbes to reduce methane is that it's a process that's already underway. We're looking at processes that have been happening for thousands and thousands, if not billions, of years, she said. The question is whether or not we can enhance those processes that are already happening. What's helpful to remember, too, is that though it's just one early-stage effort to use science to address the threat and harm of climate change, there are other efforts being developed all over the world. We're opening the floodgates for new ideas, said Melamed. We need to put everything on the table now. Up in the trees, in Howland Research Forest, Savage stays busy clipping trees from mid-canopy. Like any scientist, she's driven by these questions, by what we don't yet know, and the possibility that lies within those answers. In this case, the answer that may buy the planet some needed time is one that was already written by nature. We just need to listen. Karen?
Thanks, Pamela. Wrong way crashes on the rise in Massachusetts. State makes changes to road signs, adds cameras. A Massachusetts state trooper, already off duty, killed responding to an errant Jeep. A Gloucester teenager, newly graduated from high school, struck head-on on Route 128. And a Haverhill man, mangled in the aftermath of a collision while driving down Interstate 93. These are just three lives claimed by wrong-way car crashes that are increasingly common in Massachusetts. The trifecta of fatal accidents in the final days of June, followed by yet another Monday, underscores how the problem has metastasized in Massachusetts. Citations for wrong-way driving have exploded in recent years, and the number of deaths climbed. In each of the last 2 years, the state issued more than 500 citations to drivers on state highways, the Massachusetts Turnpike, and the Boston Harbor Tunnels, a Globe analysis of state data found. And 2026 is on track to outpace those figures, with the state already logging nearly 270 citations by late June. Wrong-way crashes tend to be at least 12 times deadlier than other car accidents, studies show. And their causes are frustratingly difficult to pin down to a single source. Now, state officials are rushing to implement a new $75 million program that includes a constellation of cameras, new road signs, and infrastructure improvements designed to prevent wrong-way collisions. Massachusetts supercharged the effort after the death of State Trooper Kevin Traynor spurred calls for stronger action, including from Governor Maura Healey, said Jonathan Gulliver, a state undersecretary of transportation. Gulliver said the Massachusetts Department of Transportation now expects to mount 430 detection cameras by the end of 2027. The system notifies wrong-way drivers with an audible alarm, flashing signs, and a spotlight, then pings law enforcement if a driver does not turn around. The installation underway builds off a smaller pilot program at 16 Massachusetts locations that flagged roughly 300 wrong-way incidents since 2022. I'm not sure that wrong-way crashes happened more or less years ago, but I am certain we didn't hear about them as much when they did, Gulliver said. In all, wrong-way crashes are among the most preventable roadway accidents, but difficult to eliminate, because they cannot be tracked cleanly to one source, said AAA spokesperson Mark Shieldrop. Persistent speeding, distracting and impaired driving, and an aging population of drivers confused behind the wheel are the leading contributors to wrong-way citations, experts said. Nationally, 6 in 10 wrong-way crashes involve an alcohol-impaired driver. In one of the latest examples, state police said Monday that they charged a Lawrence man with operating under the influence after he allegedly crashed after driving south on the northbound side of Interstate 95. And the dark of night can't take all the blame either. Nearly 45% of crashes in Massachusetts occurred during daylight hours. Though a wrong-way incident can be as simple as sliding into the unintended lane on a ramp, A single mistake against the flow of traffic is often dangerous. In Massachusetts, at least 135 people have died in 5,506 wrong-way crashes on Massachusetts roads since 2018, according to AAA. That includes 22 deaths in 2025, the most in a single year during that time frame. State officials here are focusing first on divided highways, where high-speed crashes can be especially deadly. MassDOT has identified 100 high-risk spots for wrong-way detection cameras, which include crash-prone intersections already equipped with cameras in Danvers, Auburn, Braintree, Fall River, and Wheatley. Roughly 70 other roads at risk for wrong-way crashes may require larger reconstruction projects down the line, Gulliver said. State leaders also intend to install clearer wrong-way and do-not-enter signage, improve pavement markings, directional arrows, and better lighting at highway ramps and interchanges. Legislation tucked into the state's $63 billion budget plan, sent to the governor's desk Wednesday, also proposes a study to improve roadway safety for drivers over 70, an expansion of law enforcement training, and completion of an analysis of documented incidents of wrong-way driving. At a press conference following a vote on the budget amendment, Nicole Daly lauded the efforts to address the issue after her son, Christopher Daly, an 18-year-old Gloucester High School graduate and hockey team captain, died in a wrong-way crash on Route 128 last summer. "I don't want any other community to have to go through this," said Daly. "It's senseless." Across the country, fatal wrong-way crashes doubled in the decade after 2014. Recent crashes in Massachusetts have involved drivers under the influence or allegedly fleeing the state police. But many incidents can be traced back to disorientation and poor signage. Winding roads and complicated overpasses, specific to the older infrastructure and circuitous traffic patterns in Massachusetts, can add to the problem, Gulliver said. In response, state officials sourced detection technology from TAPCO, a Wisconsin-based transportation product company. The cameras, mounted on streetlight signals, use artificial intelligence and heat detection to identify wrong-way drivers and differentiate them from pedestrians, birds, and other hazards, Gulliver said. The software-based system costs $20,000 per camera to install, less than half the $70,000 price tag associated with cameras in the previous state pilot program. Those cameras use loop detection to manually identify wrong-way drivers using wiring in the roads that recognizes passing vehicles above. An average of 2 wrong-way cameras are installed each week. Some have proved to be fruitful immediately. At the intersection of Routes 128 and 35 in Danvers, where officials connected a camera on June 16th, the same day we activated it, we caught a wrong-way driver, Gulliver said. In the next few years, state officials also hope to have a system that automatically pings roadside message boards and GPS systems to notify drivers about wrong-way vehicles. Still, Massachusetts is moving more slowly than other states. Pamela?
U.S. guts efforts to avert gun violence, including funding. Shifts from focus on public health. The Trump administration has gutted federal gun violence prevention efforts since returning to office, slashing funding for programs and research, and even suppressing taxpayer-funded reports aimed at reducing gun injuries and deaths. The cutbacks, which span agencies throughout the federal government, represent a shift in philosophy about how to address gun violence, away from a public health-oriented approach focused on prevention to a law and order approach focused on beefing up police departments and seizing illegal weapons while also systematically rolling back firearms regulations. The move away from prevention and regulation aimed at saving lives is playing out in other areas of public health, too, including illegal drugs and smoking. The administration's approach to gun violence also reflects President Trump's long political alliance with gun rights groups and his determination to undo the policies of his predecessor, Joe Biden. Soon after taking office, Trump shuttered Biden's White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention ordered a review of Biden's firearms policies and issued an executive order titled Protecting Second Amendment Rights. The Justice Department's Civil Rights Division also took the highly unusual step last week of suing Virginia and California to overturn those states' restrictions on gun ownership. The suit was the division's first ever affirmative litigation in favor of expanding gun rights, said Joseph Blocker, a specialist on Second Amendment law at Duke University. Still, the cuts are perplexing to people involved in prevention work because Trump is no stranger to gun violence. He has survived three assassination attempts, and his close ally, Charlie Kirk, was gunned down while giving a speech last year. Kirk's accused assassin faces a court hearing in Utah this week. The man accused of trying to kill Trump at a press gala in April appeared in federal court in Washington last week. It is a grand irony, said Amy Solomon, who oversaw a violence prevention program at the Justice Department when she served as Assistant Attorney General in the Biden administration. That program, the Community-Based Violent Intervention and Prevention Initiative, has since lost $150 million in funding, which was steered to law enforcement, she said. The groups and organizations who work on this are very strong and very resilient, but so many of them have had to cut services, have had to lay off staff. Some of them have had to close their doors altogether, Solomon said. And what's replacing it is a very heavy-handed, law enforcement-centric focus that, frankly, isn't even focusing on the violence. Spokespeople for the White House and Departments of Justice, Homeland Security, and Health and Human Services said the administration's policies have made Americans safer while eliminating wasteful spending. The Trump administration remains totally committed to being responsible stewards of American taxpayer dollars, and that includes no longer funding programs that are wasteful, misdirected, and counterproductive, said Abigail Jackson, a White House spokesperson. Jackson and her colleagues at other agencies also credited the president with a marked decline in violent crime in 2025. But violent crime was also declining under Biden. Fatima Lauren Dreyer is the executive director of the Health Alliance for Violence Intervention, which supports hospital-based violence prevention programs and laid off 20% of its staff after the Justice Department funding was cut. She cited recent research showing that the programs based in trauma centers can successfully prevent victims of violent injuries, including gunshot wounds, from being injured again. At the Department of Homeland Security, the Center for Prevention Programs and Partnerships aimed at preventing terrorist attacks and targeted violence lost $18.5 million last year. Bill Braniff, the counterterrorism specialist who founded it, left government for academic work. Apart from declining to fund new research, the administration has also suppressed previous studies and reports. After Congress passed a bipartisan gun safety bill in 2022 that contained funding to help states enact so-called red flag laws, the Department of Health and Human Services commissioned a report on the statutes. Trump briefly embraced red flag laws, which the gun lobby fiercely opposes during his first administration in the aftermath of a mass shooting in 2019. The report, financed by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, explored the scientific evidence behind the laws and offered a guide to help state mental health and authorities enforce them. It was posted on the agency's website at the tail end of the Biden administration, but vanished after Trump took office. Karen?
Thanks, Pamela. And the next story is an update to one of the Globe's front page stories. Brigham and Women's Hospital nurses walk out, beginning largest nurses strike in state history. It's the first time nurses have gone on strike at the Brigham, a nationally renowned Harvard teaching hospital. Thousands of nurses at Brigham and Women's Hospital went on strike Wednesday as they fight with the state's largest health care system over pay increases and insurance costs. The walkout is the biggest ever for nurses in Massachusetts and the first at the Brigham, a nationally renowned Harvard teaching hospital. While the strike is only scheduled for one day, nurses will be locked out of the hospital until July 13th. Brigham, one of Mass General Brigham's two flagship hospitals, is contractually obligated to provide temporary nurses with 5 days of work, MGB told staff. The Massachusetts Nurses Association, which represents about 4,000 nurses at the Brigham and MGB, have been negotiating a new contract for months to no avail. A separate group of 450 clinicians who visit patients at their homes under MGB home care also went on strike Wednesday for 7 days. MGB representatives said they have secured nearly 1,300 temporary nurses to keep the hospital running as normal. But that hasn't stopped the patients and policy leaders from worrying about the ramifications of the work stoppage. Governor Maura Healey called a meeting of both sides Monday to negotiate, to no avail. In a joint statement Tuesday, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey, and Representative Stephen Lynch and Ayanna Pressley urged both sides to continue negotiating. Nurses are the backbone of our health care system, and we rely on their skills, compassion, and tireless work ethic to care for our loved ones, the statement said, adding that the Brigham nurses and MGB home care workers deserve a fair contract that reflects the essential contributions they make each and every day. Both sides are particularly far apart on wages. The union wants a 3% raise for the first 6 months and a 4% raise for the next 12 months of the contract. The hospital isn't offering any new across-the-board raise. Management points out nurses already receive a 5% raise on the yearly anniversary of their hiring, a so-called step increase, until they reach 2 decades of service, which helps make Brigham nurses among the highest paid in the state. For health insurance, management wants nurses who are enrolled in Harvard Pilgrim Health Plan, which is more than half of the membership, to pay 2.5 percentage points more of their monthly premium. MGB said the nurses' demands are not financially sustainable and not supported by the current labor market. MGB home care clinicians are seeking caseload limits, clearer productivity standards, and higher wages. MGB spokesperson Jessica Pastore said that disruptions to care will be minimal, although some patients will have to reschedule appointments or be seen at another MGB location. The Health System Surgical Center in Foxborough will be closed Wednesday to Friday. MGB Home Care is pausing new referrals and some social work and dietitian visits. Pamela?
And now for some good news. After World Cup bus rides, Tartan Army donates $15,000 to Massachusetts students. Weeks before the first match, hundreds of Scottish fans were suddenly unsure of how they would get from Boston to Gillette Stadium to watch their team's first World Cup appearance in nearly 30 years. The transportation service they were counting on had fallen through, forcing the Tartan Army to explore alternatives. That's when 46-year-old Mike Teven thought of a classic American treasure, yellow school buses that most Scots had only known from movies and television. Teven, a construction estimator from Cambuslang, a town outside of Glasgow, hired a company to lend them 12 school buses to transport 560 fans to the stadium in Foxborough. The yellow buses saved the fans thousands of dollars, and that money is now going to Massachusetts public school students in need of books, backpacks, and clothing. The Tartan Army has donated $15,000 to Massachusetts Child, a charity led by the Massachusetts Teachers Association that supports students with financial need. "We were given a warm welcome," Teven said. "It felt fitting that we should leave something behind us, that the kids that we'd stolen the school buses from are getting the long-term benefit from it." The Tartan Army brought endless joy to Boston with their bagpipes, their kilts, and their chants. And now they're leaving better opportunities for the children of the city and state. After returning to Scotland, the fans overwhelmingly supported pooling the savings together to make a large charitable donation rather than redistributing the money to members. Despite their propensity to spend big at Boston bars, Teven said most of the Scotland fans traveling to the games were running on tight budgets. Some cashed in savings, tapped retirement pensions, and even sold properties to make the trip possible. Between lodging, tickets, and other expenses, the average fan spent around $4,000 per week to attend games, Teven said. Still, they agreed on making the donation to benefit Massachusetts children. "This generous donation is significant not only for what it will allow our members to do for their students, but also for what it represents," said Max Page, president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association. The Tartan Army showed the world what it means to care for one another, to support one another, and to celebrate together. We can't thank these soccer fans enough. The donation will be awarded to educators across the state who will identify needs among their students and support them accordingly. The most needed items are often winter clothing and backpacks, said Scott McLennan, a spokesperson for the union. The organization also provides sports equipment and art supplies. Last year, the organization awarded $61,000 to educators who identified needs in their local schools. With a donation from the Tartan Army, hundreds more children will benefit. By the end of June, TVN had emailed the union saying the Tartan Army was interested in making a donation, but were still figuring out the amount. Right before the July 4th weekend, he said they wanted to donate $15,000, McLennan said, which was much more than the union expected. We are so grateful, McLennan said. The same chartered yellow buses from First Student, a large school bus supplier based in Tartan Army fans lodging in Providence. Those Scots donated $30,000 to local Rhode Island organizations, including Hasbro Children's Hospital. The school bus experience was a highlight for the Scotland fans. The atmosphere on the bus was definitely there because of the way we were traveling, TVN said. We're not going to forget that. Karen?
Thanks, Pamela. Also from today's Metro section, DA seeks clerk's hearing on possible charge against mayor. Embattled Brockton Mayor Moises Rodriguez, a lightning rod for controversy since two students accused him of inappropriately touching them during school-related activities, could be facing a potential assault and battery charge, according to the Plymouth District Attorney's Office. The District Attorney's Office said state police detectives assigned to the office filed in an application in Brockton District Court Thursday seeking a clerk's hearing on a proposed criminal complaint charging Rodriguez with one count of assault and battery. We await the scheduling of that hearing, a spokesperson for Plymouth District Attorney Timothy J. Cruz said in an email Tuesday. The spokesperson did not specify what incident prompted investigators to seek the clerk's hearing. Efforts to reach Moises for comment were not successful Tuesday evening. Messages also were left with Brockton High School's principal, the superintendent of Brockton Public Schools, as well as the city council president. The allegations came to light in dramatic fashion on June 6 as Rodriguez, who made history last year as the first black person elected mayor in Brockton, delivered a speech at Rocky Marciano Stadium to a sea of Brockton High School graduates in red and black cap and gowns. A distraught mother of a graduate rushed toward Rodriguez, yelling at him to leave while saying, "You know what you did to my daughter," prompting police to intervene. The mother's allegations stem from an encounter her daughter had with the mayor in May while marching with the school band in a parade. Rodriguez suddenly appeared next to the 17-year-old as she played the trombone, placed his left hand on her waist, and then pulled her closer to him while he was dancing before a video camera, the girl recently testified in court. A judge in Hingham District Court elected to not extend a restraining order last week, but told the mayor his behavior was unwelcome, offensive, and certainly unprofessional. Details about the second allegation are less clear. According to a report by WGBH, the allegation involves Rodriguez making inappropriate physical contact with another student during a different school event in May. The Globe has not confirmed the second accusation. Since the accusation arose, Rodriguez, 64, a Cape Verdean immigrant who previously worked as a child protection specialist for the Archdiocese of Boston, has been the target of mounting criticism. Rodriguez secured his election victory by fewer than 300 votes over his challenger, former city councilor Jean Bradley Derrett-Nuncourt. A recount 1 month later confirmed Rodriguez's win. Derrett-Nuncourt sued the city's election commission, accusing the board of election fraud, but later dropped the suit. The allegations add to a series of challenges facing Brockton Public Schools in recent years, including scrutiny over the district's finances and student behavior. Pamela?
Here's the scuttlebutt. Before visiting the tall ships, Learn the nautical words and phrases that have sailed into everyday English. More than 60 tall ships will port around Boston Harbor from July 11th to 16th as part of Sail Boston 250, offering free public tours and the chance to step aboard some of the world's most breathtaking sailing vessels. In addition, many smaller schooners will offer charter sails for an up-close view of the fleet from the water. Along the way, you'll likely hear plenty of nautical terms and more than a few expressions you already use without realizing they began at sea. Feeling under the weather, a project that's dead in the water, some office scuttlebutt, being in the doldrums or back on an even keel, even waiting until the sun is over the yardarm before celebrating with a drink. All of these phrases trace their roots to life aboard sailing ships. Dead in the water is a terrible place to be in the ocean, with no wind and going nowhere, and on land it means much the same, a plan or design that has no chance of succeeding or moving ahead, said Eric J. Dolan, local author of the best-selling book, Wreck of the Mentor. During the grand parade of sail, you'll see traditions that have endured for centuries. As the fleet enters Boston Harbor, the cadets and crew will man the rails, standing at attention along the deck to greet the incoming crew. Whether walking aboard a 357-foot vessel above and below deck, or out on a schooner sail around the harbor, visitors will hear the captain and crews use some nautical terms and commands, but the main point is to enjoy the experience. Don't hesitate to ask the crew and captain friendly questions, as they love to talk and share stories, said Carol Kent, president of Carol Kent Yacht Charters International, a longtime Boston area company. This is a chance to learn more about them. Ask them about their long ocean passages and what the food is like. Ask them who gets to go up in the rigging and how that feels. Have your children ask them fun questions like how they came to sail on a tall ship. Before visiting the tall ships, here's a guide to the nautical terms, commands, and colorful sayings to know. Basic layout of the ship. Aft, towards the stern or rear of the vessel. Beam, the widest point of the ship. Bow, the front of the ship is designed to cut through the water. Draft, how deeply the vessel sits in the water, measuring from the waterline to the bottom of the keel. Galley, the ship's kitchen where all meals are prepared. Gunwale, the upper edge of the side of the boat, pronounced gunnel, name for where the guns on a ship would sit. To be full to the gunnels means to be completely full. Halyards and sheets. Halyards are the lines used to hoist the sails up the mast, while sheets are used to trim and control the sail's angle to the wind. Hatch, an opening in the deck fitted with a watertight cover. Heads, marine toilets on board. Headwinds, winds blowing in the opposite direction of the ship's movement, has also come to mean resistance or opposition to a plan, often referred to as economic headwinds in business. Helm, the steering mechanism, wheel or tiller. The person steering is called the helmsperson. Jib, a triangular head sail set forward of the foremost mast. Lines, there are no ropes on a tall ship, only lines, each designated by its purpose, e.g. halyards, sheets. Port and starboard. Port is on the left side of the ship when facing forward. Remember, red, left, port, and starboard is the right side. Rigging. The lines supporting the masts are the standing rigging, while the ropes used to manage the sails are the running rigging. Square rigged. Sails bent to horizontal yards, designed to run best with the wind coming from behind. Stern. The rear section of the vessel. Yard. The horizontal wooden spar attached to the mast that holds the top edge of a square sail. Nautical commands and sayings. All hands. A command calling the entire crew on deck for duty, an emergency, or to adjust heavy sails. Cast off. To untie a line completely and let it go. Crow's nest. A platform located high on a mast used as a lookout point. The term is sometimes used metaphorically for the topmost structures in buildings, towers, etc. Dead in the water. Without wind, the vessel's not moving. Dress the ship. A term that goes back to the 17th century, where ships will fly flags and banners to display their allegiance. Even keel, the equilibrium and balance of a vessel in the water. Furl, to roll or fold the sail tightly against the mast or yardarm, securing it with gaskets when it's not in use. heave, haul, to pull hard in a line. Sailors often yell, heave, together, so everyone pulls at the exact same moment. Helms a lee, hard to lee. The steering wheel is being turned hard toward the side of the ship, away from the wind. This is used when making a big turn. Hoist away. This is the command to pull the sail up into the air. In the doldrums, a term that refers to a belt around the earth near the equator where there's little surface wind for ships. Ships can be adrift or stuck in the doldrums for days or weeks. Keel over, a term which derives from a ship tilting so far over to one side that it capsizes. Lower the boom. The boom is the long horizontal pole that controls the movement of the mainsail. It can deliver sailors a knockout blow if it swings wildly or collapses in heavy weather. These days, the phrase means to put a stop to, chastise, or rebuke. Man the lines. This tells the sailors to go to a specific rope and hold on to it, ready to pull. Man the rails. A classic maritime tradition when a tall ship or naval vessel arrives in port, cadets stand attention along the deck to show respect to the host country, honor the ship, and greet the incoming crew. Mind your helm. A warning to the person steering to pay closer attention and keep the ship on course. Muster, an order for the crew to gather in one place for a head count or to get instructions. Over the yardarm, the team originated in the 19th century on square rig sailing ships, and when the sun is over the yardarm, the horizontal spar attached to the mast from which sails are hung, it's considered the proper time of day to drink rum. Run aground or high and dry. To run aground is when the bottom of the boat hits the seafloor and stops the boat. For a ship to run aground in a receding tide is to be left high and dry. Getting stuck with a check when everyone else has taken off is also to be left high and dry. Scuttlebutt. During the age of sail, sailors gathered around a water barrel or wooden butt, which had a hole or scuttle for drawing water. During this respite from the demanding work of sailing a ship, they swapped stories, information, and gossip. According to Dolan, sea legs, the ability to adjust to the motion of a ship and maintain balance. To have one's sea legs is to be able to walk calmly and steadily on a tossing ship, or to be accustomed to a new and strange situation. Ship shape and Bristol fashion, a popular idiom meaning something is perfectly neat, tidy, and excellent working order. Slack away, ease away. This means to slowly let out a line so it becomes loose. Son of a gun. A widely repeated explanation traces the phrase to children conceived or even born on a ship's gun deck after women were invited or smuggled aboard while the ship was in port. Stand by. This tells the crew to get ready at their stations and wait for the next command. Steady as she goes. This tells the person steering the ship to keep moving straight in the exact same direction. Under the weather, a term dating back to the 19th century, when during a rough storm or difficult ocean passage, sailors would retreat below deck to the weather bow, front, high side of the ship, which was being sailed closest to the wind and offered a sheltered place to ride out a storm.
Karen? Well, that was quite a complete nautical education, mateys. Our next article is Outrage Greets Video of Bagel Customer Tossing Food on the Floor. Around 8 a.m. the Sunday before last, the bagel shop Spot in Norwood was bustling with dozens of customers. Behind the counter, owner Perry Makarios was making his signature hand-baked bagels when he turned around to an odd sight. The discarded remains of a bagel sandwich, half-bitten pieces, the container it came in, and crumpled napkins were strewn across the ground. Makarios has been in the business for 35 years. He knew this was no accident. "You can tell this stuff is thrown," he said. Employees cleaned up the mess, but at the end of the day, the 52-year-old looked over his surveillance footage to find who was responsible. What he saw confirmed his suspicions. Video showed a middle-aged man picking his bagel sandwich apart and tossing portions onto the floor before brusquely shoving the container full of food aside. Its contents spilled out. He looked annoyed while the woman next to him appeared startled. "I couldn't believe it," Macario said. "I had to watch it like 12 times to really wrap my head around it." The clip, which he promptly uploaded to Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, has now been viewed millions of times, sparking outrage among commenters, most of whom express support for the shop. "Please, if you know this person, tell him to learn some manners," the caption reads. The cashier told Macario she remembered the customer. After the man placed his order for a couple of bagel sandwiches, which are cooked on the spot, she informed him the wait would be around 15 minutes, Macarios recalled. It was a few minutes longer. When his name was called out, the man approached to collect his food. He was visibly unhappy. She apologized, noting how busy it was, and moved on to the next patron, Macario said. The man then apparently took his anger out on the meal. His eyes remained locked on the cashier as he chucked his purchase, Macarios added. While it's generally regarded as taboo in the industry to post anything that casts customers in a negative light, Macario said, the man's behavior was so rude that he was compelled to share the video to show people that such conduct is not acceptable, not only in my restaurant, but society in general. We have really, really nice customers. We love our customers, but there's one or two people like this that make it really difficult, he said. They're so accustomed to treating the service people in any way they want to. And in the vast majority of cases, they just have to sit back and take the hostility, Macario said. But there is a fine line that you have to draw, he added. Macario said he contacted police about the incident, but they said it was more of a civil matter. But the benefit of posting the video on social media, he said, is that people are inclined to weigh in and hand out their verdict. They have indeed. In recent days, the customer's actions have been widely condemned, and the bagel shop has received overwhelming support, including from former Patriots captain David Andrews. Other restaurant owners have also reached out, saying the 39-second clip encapsulates the realities of the industry today, he said. Macario said he's received hundreds of thousands of messages. He didn't expect the video would go viral, but said he believed it struck a chord. The alleged customer did not respond to a request for comment. Hopefully he learns a lesson, or anybody else who's deciding to trash a restaurant, Macario said. If you have a problem in a restaurant, you just go online and write a bad review, or don't spend your money there. Pamela?
A festive night of global flavors. From delicate steamed dumplings and crispy empanadas to fiery Caribbean stews and fragrant Indian curries, Greater Boston's dining scene is a passport to nearly every corner of the globe. And if you'd like to taste many of those flavors in one night, from neighborhood favorites to hidden gems, make plans for the 12th annual A Taste of Ethnic Boston, one of the city's biggest and most delicious celebrations of culture and cuisine. The festival returns to Big Night Live next to TD Garden on Tuesday, July 28th, from 5:30 to 8 p.m., bringing together nearly two dozen restaurants and food and beverage vendors, many of them family-owned. Come hungry. Shea Empanada will be serving its popular beef and chicken empanadas in both regular and spicy versions, along with caprese-filled empanadas packed with cheese, tomato, and basil. Shanti Restaurant is bringing its beloved papri chaat, an Indian street food made with crunchy wafers, chickpeas, potatoes, and onions, then drizzled with yogurt and sweet tamarind chutney. Wash it down with the restaurant's rosemint limeade. And don't miss Love Art's Sushi's Sushi Salad, a deconstructed sushi roll featuring raw tuna and salmon, curried chickpeas, and seasoned rice. But the evening is about far more than great food. Founded by Colette Phillips of Get Connected, the festival celebrates the diversity that defines Boston. The networking organization works to promote cross-cultural business and social connections. Meet Boston, along with Big Night Entertainment, NBC 10 Boston, and the City of Boston, sponsors the tasting. It's a culinary event that aligns with our efforts to showcase the diversity of our neighborhoods, said Martha Sheridan, president and CEO of Meet Boston. The participating restaurateurs love it too, because it gives them a chance to interact directly with the community. We love being there and meeting everyone. It makes us feel so included, said Shea Empanada owner Albie Alvarez-Cote. For Rokeya Begum, co-owner of Shanti, the festival highlights how special it is to live in a place with so many cultures and cuisines. It's not the same in every city or town, she said. Having events like this is a reminder that we're not just feeding people, said Ron Lui of Love Art Sushi. There's a story behind what we're doing. Buy tickets. We start at $33.85 at eventbrite.com. Karen?
Thanks, Pamela. Storms douse parts of southern New England with heavy rain. A slow-moving summer storm drenched parts of southern New England with 1 to nearly 6 inches of rain from Monday through Tuesday evening, flooding some roads but largely sparing the region from major damage. The heaviest rain fell along the southern New England coastline from Connecticut to Cape Cod and the islands, though some isolated inland areas also saw heavy downpours. Among the hardest hit communities was Falmouth, which received 5.91 inches of rain, according to the National Weather Service. Woods Hole recorded 5.75 inches. After the deluge, the Falmouth Police Department warned residents Tuesday morning about flooding on Main Street and Falmouth Heights Road, urging drivers not to attempt to cross the flooded roadways. Video by NBC 10 Boston showed a black Ford Mustang partially submerged in floodwaters and several vehicles attempting to navigate inundated streets. Despite the rainfall, a Falmouth police dispatcher said Tuesday that no reports of road closures, significant flooding, or power outages had come through the dispatch center overnight. And that's all the time we have left for today's reading of the Boston Globe. This is Karen.
And Pamela.
Thanking all of you, as always, for joining us today and urging you to stay tuned for today's reading of the Boston Herald.
Are the death notices for Wednesday, July 8th, of Acton, Joan L. Carlson, of Bedford, Thomas Irwin Salzer, of Boston, Donald Crocker, James Vincent Morris, Bridget Phyllis Green Pasciuccio, Edward Arthur Schwartz, of Bridgewater, Harriet Rowe Almquist, of Brighton, Francis A. Lawless, of Brockton, Harriet Rowe Almquist, of Brookline, James Vincent Morris, Thomas Irwin Salzer, Edward Arthur Schwartz, of Burlington, Ralph Surianello. Of Cambridge, Dorothy J. Dory McDonnell. Of Canton, Bridget Phyllis Green Pasciuccio. Of Cohasset, Edward Arthur Schwartz. Of Dedham, Marianne McMahon O'Malley. Of Foxborough, Joan L. Carlson. Of Gloucester, Donald Crocker. Of Hanson, Francis A. Lawless. Of Hingham, Lois Henderson Mann. Of Jamaica Plain, Donald Crocker. Of Littleton, Joanne Jody Miller Carrington. Of Malden, Jean Philip Red Rava. Of Medford, Elizabeth A. Rapallo Camerata, Ralph Surianello. Of Mission Hill, Marianne McMahon O'Malley. Of Needham, Harriet Rowe Almquist. Of Newton, Agape Delginides, Thomas Irwin Salzer. Of North Andover, Elizabeth A. Rapallo Camerata. Of Plymouth, Tina Ann Cresta. Of Roslindale, Marianne McMahon O'Malley. Of Roxbury, Beverly Warren McLean. Of Sandwich, Thomas Irwin Salzer. Of Saugus, Tina Ann Cresta. Of Sharon, Thomas Irwin Salzer. Of South Weymouth, Edward Robert Quinn. Of Stoneham, Elizabeth A. Rapallo Camerata. Of Stoughton, Joan L. Carlson. Of Wakefield, Tina Ann Cresta. Stuart Knowlton Gibson III. Of Waltham, Stuart Knowlton Gibson III. Of Watertown, Dorothy J. Dory McDonnell. Of West Roxbury, Francis A. Lawless, Marianne McMahon O'Malley. Of Westwood, Joan L. Carlson, Marianne McMahon O'Malley. Of Wilmington, Ralph Surianello. Of Winchester, Stuart Knowlton Gibson III. And of Woburn, Ralph Surianello. This concludes the death notices for Wednesday, July 8th.
Hey, wouldn't it be great if life came with a remote control? You know, you could hit pause when you needed to, or hit rewind, like that time you knocked down that wasp's nest.
Uh-oh.
Or that time you forgot to roll up your